This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Now, Will Smith's latest sports drama, Concussion, is generating a lot of buzz about, well, you guessed it, head injuries. The film's leading man is not the only reason concussions have been in the news lately, either. The more scientists learn about concussions or traumatic brain injury, TBI, the more adverse long-term effects they're discovering. Just last year, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a new recommendation to improve player safety in youth football, including zero tolerance for illegal head-first hits and expanding on non-tackling leagues. According to the CDC, the overall number of children and teens who are diagnosed with concussions or TBI is on the rise. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with two people who are both experts in head injury and traumatic brain injury and concussions and all of that kind of stuff about exactly this topic, what it is that we can do. The deal is that it is really common for kids to sustain head injuries in sports accidents or even everyday play and other mishaps, which is exactly why it's so important for parents to understand that concussions are much more serious than just the knock in the head, that they can actually negatively affect children for the rest of their lives. We'll begin our discussion of head injuries and concussions and everything you need to know to protect yourself and your family when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
This heavyweight bout is about to begin. The challenger wears white trunks with a blue stripe, and the champ is wearing, looks like an examination gown from the doctor's office. And from the back, we can... Ooh, that's not pretty. Champ, what's with the crazy getup?
I've got to take care of my family.
Yeah, so?
Well, when you love your family, you got to go in and get those important medical screenings. A lot of potentially deadly diseases can be treated if you catch them in time.
So you wear the examination gown because...
Because I'm a real man. Real men take care of their families and get those tests. Real men wear gowns.
Okay, champ, good luck. Here we go. The champ's not wasting any time. Oh, it's over. This fight is over. Champ, you barely broke a sweat. Any words for your fans out there?
Remember, go to ahrq.gov for a list of the tests they need to get and when to get them.
What was that web address again?
ahrq.gov. And remember, real men wear gowns.
Go to ahrq.gov. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AHRQ, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Rebecca Carl, who is a sports medicine specialist at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago and also an assistant professor at Northwestern University. Rebecca, let's talk about concussions. And mentioned during a previous segment that there's a movie out there with Will Smith called Concussion, and it's bringing a little bit more attention to the whole issue. I think anybody who's followed sports anytime recently will be aware of these kinds of things. I mean, we see that kids who are getting hit in the head have got to sit out for a little while, or perhaps longer than a game. And if you watch professional sports, we know that hockey players have to be out for a certain time, or football players have to pass certain kinds of protocols. Are we just becoming more aware of concussions and brain injuries, or are they happening more often?
I think it's probably a combination of those two factors, but the main factor is that we're increasingly identifying children who have concussions, and adults for that matter. Going back to the 1990s, we used to not count concussions unless there was a loss of consciousness, so somebody had to pass out to be diagnosed with a concussion. And even if somebody briefly passed out, they were generally not diagnosed with a concussion. It was mainly the athletes who were lying unconscious on the football field, getting carted off on a golf cart. Those are the ones where they'd say, yep, you have a concussion. Even when they were recognized, athletes would routinely get sent back to play after about a week. We don't really know where the one-week rule came about, but probably it's because the majority of the concussions were happening in football, and football games are every week. So you'd have a concussion and they'd say, oh, you can go back next week. So So I think we've started to try and pull out more kids who have concussions because we've realized, one, is that these injuries can be cumulative, meaning a child can have a concussion and have symptoms, and then they go back before they're fully recovered and have another concussion, and the symptoms just get piled up on top of each other, and the recovery can be longer. But we also realized that there were people who were returning to play symptomatic, and you know, we should be treating these injuries like we treat, you know, a knee injury or an ankle injury. So if an athlete comes to my clinic and they're limping, I don't say, oh, let's get you back to football in a week. We say, let's see how you're doing and how the injury recovery progresses, and then we'll determine when you get back to play.
Well, how do you do that? I guess let's start with the older athletes, and we'll get into some of the younger ones. Because, I mean, so many, particularly football players or rugby players or pretty much any male athlete especially, there's going to be a sense of, okay, so I've got a bang here, or I've got a fracture. I can handle it for however long a game is. And if you add up all the minutes of football, it's not the whole 60 minutes. You're only on the field half the time anyway, and of those, it's just a couple seconds here and there. So, you know, it's not that big of a deal. How do you overcome that?
That's actually been a major obstacle, and there's been a lot of research studies on this. So there was one study done in Milwaukee high school football players, and they found out that basically about a third of the athletes had symptoms of a concussion in the preceding season. And only about half of them reported that to an adult. So there's definitely a gap between the injuries and the symptoms and the kids coming off of the field. When they asked those athletes, well, why didn't you tell an adult? The number one reason is actually that they didn't know that the symptoms were important. But the number two reason was that they didn't want to get pulled from play.
There it is, yeah.
Right. So the first reason we can address, and I think really the medical community and the media have addressed this by just the discussion of how important it is to recognize the signs and symptoms of concussion and not to continue playing. But we still have the second obstacle, which is kids love their sports and they don't want to get pulled from play, and adults for that matter. There are, you know, we've developed some tests that are a little bit more objective at looking at the signs and symptoms of concussion, and we've put a lot of time and energy in the medical community into educating coaches and officials so that they can help us recognize when kids are not acting right, mm-hmm. and they can be pulled from play.
Well,
but I think there really has been a culture shift, because I used to watch football games and hear the announcer saying, why is that guy coming out of the game? You know, he just got his bell rung. And now you see the opposite. Announcers will say, how could they be putting him back into the game after that hit? And so to me, that's a really positive change.
I guess, yeah. I mean, it's aware, but I think there's also a certain sense of lack of understanding of what the symptoms are. Because you talk about the bell ring, or you hear about seeing stars or vomiting or loss of consciousness. Those are pretty obvious kinds of things. But you can have some significant damage, particularly over a long period of time, from doing something like heading a soccer ball, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's,
well,
clear. You know,
yeah,
it's not going to leave any bruises. It's,
right.
You know, it's. So, go ahead.
The act of heading, it doesn't look like actually making contact with your head to the ball, even repeatedly, doesn't seem to be a cause of later impairments. It's probably more that people, when they go up for a header, they're more likely to make contact with another player. So that's when they're likely to hit heads with another player or get hit in the head with an elbow. We worry about that. About heading because of that, but the actual act of heading doesn't seem to increase the risk of later problems. But you're right, it can be really difficult to identify concussion. One of the things we do with concussed athletes is we give them a list of symptoms. There's actually over 20 symptoms on the list, and we ask them to score the presence of those symptoms on a scale of 0 to 6, meaning that they don't have the symptom, and 6 being at its worst. And a lot of those symptoms are not specific, so some of them are things like feeling dizzy or inability to concentrate or feeling more tired than usual. And we certainly have athletes who may feel more tired because they were up late the night before, or they're feeling dizzy because they were dehydrated. So that is one of the difficulties in recognizing and treating concussions, is that many of the symptoms aren't specific to concussion. And so that makes it hard to tell an athlete, okay, when you have this symptom, it means this.
Okay.
But we can give pretty good guidelines, and I think we've gotten much better at doing that.
And are there specific protocols that you go through, or that sports teams are supposed to go through when there is something that looks at least outwardly like it might be a concussion?
Yeah, so we have a definition of concussion, and the definition that most people use comes from this set of consensus guidelines about concussion in sport. Every 3 or 4 years ago, there's this international group of concussion experts that includes physicians, including sports medicine doctors and neurologists. It includes psychologists, athletic trainers, neuroscientists, and they get together every few years. The meetings have all been in Europe, and they come up with this document that's a consensus guideline reviewing all the recent research on concussions and coming up with recommendations. And so the most recent meeting was in Zurich, and we refer to those guidelines as the Zurich guidelines. And those give a very nice framework for how to recognize and treat concussions. But the most recent set is from 2014. And even since 2014, things have changed in the research on concussion. So those guidelines are not really set in stone. It's more opinions from a group of experts. But they are very helpful. One thing that's changed a lot is we used to say when an athlete had a concussion, they really needed to engage in complete rest. One of my patients the other day said, his father said, my child was like a potted plant after his concussion. He didn't do anything. And I thought that was a really great analogy. But we used to say, no, you know, sit in a dark room, turn off the lights. No, don't have any fun. Don't do any kind of physical activity or mental activity. And there's some studies coming up out that really show that type of drastic rest isn't necessary or productive.
I kind of wonder whether it might be counterproductive. I mean, most other things, you know, if you're able, you getting up and doing light exercise gets the blood flowing again and keeps things from solidifying or getting, you know, keep you from getting stiff. You'd think that the same would apply to a brain injury, wouldn't it? That you'd want to start exercising the brain, get blood flowing through it and all that?
It is true, and it's funny because there's almost no area of medicine where we say if you're injured, if you're hurt, if you have surgery, just stay in bed and be a potted plant.
Yeah.
Sometimes that was referred to as cocoon therapy because it was like being in a cocoon. Even if you have your appendix out, the next day they say, come on, we got to get you walking down the hall. And that's really what the research shows is that there was a study that compared children who went to the emergency room with a concussion, and they compared children who were randomized to either a very strict rest protocol for 5 days where they were told to do absolutely nothing, or they would leave it to the usual protocol of the emergency room physicians. And the protocol, as it turned out, was to just take it easy for 1 or 2 days. And the group that did less rest, group that just took it easy for a day or two, they actually had shorter recovery times. So it does seem that too much rest is harmful. There was another study that had kids keep an activity diary after concussion, and they found that when they divided the kids into 4 groups, the quartile that did the most activity did the worst in terms, they had the longest recovery. But the other 3 groups were pretty similar. So to me, when I take the studies on rest and concussion together, I think that moderate activity is probably best. We do hold kids out of activities where there's a high concussion risk. So things like organized sports are out, but often we'll let them do light aerobic activity in the early weeks after concussion.
Right.
I'll let them do limited screen time, things like texting, video games, computers, and we'll reintroduce them to school fairly quickly.
Okay. Talking with Rebecca Carl, who's a sports medicine specialist at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. She's also an assistant professor at Northwestern University. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about head injuries and concussions with Rebecca Carl.
It's Practical Polly Radio. I've switched to cooking with healthier oils. So now what do I do with all these tubs of lard? Skinny jeans feeling too tight? A bit of lard on your hips and thighs and those pants slide on like a dream. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola info.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, talking with Dr. Rebecca Carl, who's a sports medicine specialist at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. She's also an assistant professor at Northwestern University. And want to talk a little bit about youth sports, very young kids. I mean, how, if you're on the sidelines, how can you tell the difference between 2 kids running into each other and 2 kids running into each other, where one of them is actually going to suffer a potentially damaging brain problem? I mean, you know, you might not see the right angle. You can't even see some of these things on professional sports unless you look at 4 different camera angles to see whether somebody got smacked a particular way. How, as a coach or a parent, how do you assess? I mean, not every bang is worth pulling a kid out for a week, right?
Right. So we have a definition of concussion we use, and the definition is that there's some type of force applied to the head. So that can either be getting hit directly, so if somebody, you know, two heads hit each other, that would be a force that would explain a concussion. The other way that you can have a force applied is to have what we call a linear acceleration force or a rotational acceleration force, and those are just fancy ways of saying a whiplash type of injury where your head gets snapped from side to side or from front to back. So you have to have force. The second criteria is that you have to have symptoms. So those symptoms could be headache, dizziness, balance disturbance, feeling out of it. There's a big range of symptoms, and we try and educate coaches and athletes about those types of symptoms. And then the third criteria is that those have to be connected. So if somebody says, I have a headache and 2 weeks ago I hit my head, we wouldn't call that a concussion. We think that generally the symptoms should develop within hours to about a day after the injury. And then the fourth criteria for concussion is that our standard kinds of head imaging, like CT scan and MRI, are normal. And so we sometimes use those tests to evaluate for another type of injury. But with concussion, those scans are normal. So taking out the scan, because the scans we usually do in kids where we're especially concerned, those first three things, certainly with every single blow, we don't assume that there's a concussion. But we do try and educate kids and coaches and parents about the signs, and we tell coaches to be on the lookout for their kids not responding correctly to direction or to not remembering plays. We tell parents, because they're the ones that know their kids best, to keep an eye out if they think their kids aren't acting right. But even with those things, there are going to be children who have a blow to the head, and it's not recognized at the time that it's a force that could cause concussion.
Okay.
And the vast, vast majority of those kids will end up doing fine. So even though I think there's this perception that if you have a concussion, it's going to cause permanent damage, the vast, vast majority of kids who have 1, 2, 3 concussions end up doing well and not having any kind of permanent neurologic injury.
Yeah.
And we just have to do our best to sort of educate officials, coaches, parents, and kids that when they have those symptoms, they need to come out. But I would say probably about, when I see children with concussion, probably about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 tells me, you know what, I didn't really think it was that bad, and I went back to playing. And then after the game or in the third quarter, I started to feel worse, and then I let my coach know.
I'm wondering, we talk so much about in sports and youth sports and older kids, but as you're learning to walk, I mean, you're obviously not falling from great heights, but kids are smacking their heads, I don't know, dozens of times, hundreds of times, certainly while they're learning to walk before they get a good hang of it. Are those causing some concussions, do you think?
Yeah, we really don't. We don't think so, and it's funny because I have a toddler, and we joke that she has a headband of bruises around her forehead because she's always banging into things, and she seems to be developing just fine. And there are people who argue that with concussions, the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction, so we used to not recognize these important injuries at all, and now we're recognizing too many. But I think the message is not so much, did my child have an injury? Is this going to cause damage? But more managing these, if kids have an injury and they're having symptoms, just keeping them out of things that have a high contact risk until they've recovered from that. Because with a toddler, they might hit their head, and certainly they could do it again within the next few days, but you're not sending them into a situation where there's a very high likelihood of head injury. And the other thing is that the forces are less because the smaller body is lower to the ground. So that's probably a variable for toddlers.
Right, that's true. But bigger, heavier heads, too, with less inside of it. Now, talk
sure.
about the difference between boys and girls here, because that's something that I think was a little surprising, that certainly girls are getting involved in more sports that have more contact, but there's also some indications that they may be more susceptible.
That's true. So since Title IX was passed in the early 70s, the incidence of girls' participation in sports has risen about 900%. So we certainly see more girls who participate in sports. But interestingly, in sports where boys and girls participate at similar rates, girls have higher rates of concussion. So for football, we don't see, there are girls who play football, but not large numbers of them, so that's not well tracked. We know that the concussion rate is very high. But soccer also has a high rate of concussion, and it's higher for girls than for boys. And there's a lot of theories about why that is. One theory is that it has to do with neck strength. So if you get hit and you have a whiplash type injury and your neck isn't as strong, that maybe the effects of that are greater. And there's been some sort of mixed results in studies looking at strengthening the neck to see if that prevents concussion. Another theory is that maybe it's more socially acceptable for girls to report symptoms. So there's this attitude that boys are supposed to be tough.
Right.
And so if they have a concussion, they shouldn't say anything. We don't totally understand all the factors, but that is true. Girls, for the sports that girls and boys play, girls have a higher rate of concussion. And it's funny because I'll have parents bring a child to my clinic and they'll say, oh, I'm never going to let my son play football. I'm so glad my daughter plays soccer. And I think, oh, it's not quite as high of a concussion rate as soccer, but it's fairly high. I have to say, though, that my overall message when parents ask me about their children playing sports is that sports have many, many wonderful benefits for children who participate. Children who play sports are healthier adults. They have lower rates of things like metabolic syndrome and heart disease, and there's lots of psychological benefits. And so in general, even though I worry about kids getting injured in sports, I'm very happy when I see kids who are really engaged in athletics and who love their sport, even if they're sports that have a high risk of concussion.
Now, would you talk a little bit more about the cumulative effect of these things? And I guess in two different ways. One, if you go in, you have a second injury or a third injury before the first one has had a chance to heal, or just kind of over a long period of time, regular smacks, and how those create long-term damage.
So one of the questions about long-term damage, some of the difficulty in looking at this is that when we really started paying attention to concussions, we were including the concussions where people had loss of part of the definition was loss of consciousness. And it's estimated that for every 10 concussions where there's loss of, or for every concussion where there's a loss of consciousness, there are 10 concussions without. So some studies, for example, in the NFL, where they looked at people who had 3 recorded concussions, those people may have had 30 or more concussions. But there were studies that were done in NFL athletes that showed that they did worse on certain types of testing. They divide, for the sake of the study, the investigators divided into athletes who had 3 or more concussions and those who'd had less than 3 and found a difference in performance on certain types of neuropsychologic testing. So, but for kids, we worry a lot less for kids than for people who've made their careers in NFL or NHL with just so many years of accumulated playing time, highest levels of competition, the hardest hits against the largest bodies. For kids, we worry more that if you have a concussion and then you go back to play too soon, that you could have, and you have another concussion, it will just lead to a prolonged recovery. So that's our main concern with kids. There is this concept of something called second impact syndrome, and it's the idea that if you have a concussion and then you don't recover and you go back in, you can have a catastrophic brain injury afterwards from the second concussion. And those second impact syndrome seems to be a very rare event. So if you look through the medical literature, it's several dozen cases of that, which is a very small number when you think about the kids who've had concussions. Yeah. So we're not really worried about second impact syndrome. That's not the reason that we want to recognize concussions. It's more that we think this is an injury and we don't want to send children to play sports with an injury that could be made worse. I always say about the attention that's paid for to concussion, as a sports medicine doctor, it's a blessing and a curse, because I think it's a very important issue. And I'm glad that there's more attention and that the culture is changing. But then I also have parents who are so worried that they want to pull their children from sports. And they say, you know, I just can't stand the thought of them playing sports because I hear these terrible things about what happens in the NFL. So to me, the concerns about kids having a second concussion, we do sometimes see kids who have really prolonged symptoms, and that's provoked by going back to play too soon. Really our concern is just, we want to treat these like we treat other injuries. So if there was an ankle sprain, we wouldn't let a child go back to play limping. And if there's a kid who has concussion and they're still symptomatic, we want to make sure that they're recovered before they go back.
Dr. Rebecca Carls, sports medicine specialist at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago and also an assistant professor at Northwestern University. Any place where we can find out more information about the Lurie Hospital or...
Yeah, actually, our website, which is luriechildrens.org, does have a lot of information on concussion. And we also have some other injury prevention programs, like knee injury prevention programs, for people who are interested in injury prevention.
Great. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
My son Casey was a bright, fearless 20-year-old with a boundless future ahead of him. But in the blink of an eye, he was gone. While out riding a skateboard, Casey fell. He was not wearing a helmet. Our whole family wishes he was. It could have saved his life. I'm Captain Kevin Raffelli of the San Mateo Police Department. Parents, encourage your kids to strap on a helmet every time they jump on a bike, scooter, or skateboard. Think of my son Casey and use your head. Put a helmet on. It could save your life.
A message from the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and, you know, it's time, as you might imagine, to talk toys for just a little bit here. You know, some games are pretty much ready to go right out of the box. You just open it up, you take it out, you maybe plug it in. Hopefully you don't have to plug everything in. You pop in the batteries, and you're ready to roll. But there are a lot of other toys, and we're big fans of those around here, of games and activities that require a little bit more interaction, things that you've got to put together, a little bit of assembly. And I want to talk about a couple of those now. Light It and Shake It from Lectrify, and that's Lectrify without an E in the beginning. Now, Lectrify is a new company, and their mission is to make it easy and accessible for makers of all ages to build mechanical and electronic projects. That's their quote. And after trying two of their kits, I can assure you that the company is achieving that goal. The core of each kit is a fully functional circuit board. Light It includes a battery, two LEDs, an on-off switch, and a momentary switch, which is like an on-off switch, except it only works when you hold it and press it. Shake It includes a battery, an on-off switch, a vibrating motor, and more. Young makers and, of course, their parents can experiment with the board, and then when you're feeling confident, you can snap the components out of the board and embed them in any project that you like. One especially cool feature of these projects from Lectrify is that the circuit components are compatible with Lego and other systems, so it's really easy to add some special features to your Lego creations. The possibilities are unlimited, but if you want a couple suggestions, and there's not a bad thing to have some suggestions to help you point in a particular direction, there are a lot on their website. It's for ages 5 and up, and you definitely are going to have some adult supervision, especially for the younger kids. Prices vary, of course, and more information is at lectrify.it. The Totally Irresponsible Science Kit from Sean Connolly. Sean Connolly, who has been a guest on this show, has done a great service for science and math. He's making both subjects a lot more interesting and engaging. And the title of two of his books, or the titles of two of his previous books, should give you an idea of his strategy. One is called The Book of Potentially Catastrophic Science, 50 Experiments for Daring Young Scientists, and the other one is called The Book of Perfectly Perilous Math, 24 Death-Defying Challenges for Young Mathematicians. The experiments in this particular book, and it's a book-kit combo, aren't terribly new, but it's the approach that counts. For example, learning how to make bubbles out of soap or generate static electricity is okay, yawn. But when you put it in terms of encasing your brother in a giant bubble or shooting a bolt of lightning from your fingertip, now you've got something fun. This kit includes the book, a beaker, a test tube, and measuring spoon and some goggles. The rest of the ingredients you probably have around the house. It's for ages 7 and up and costs about $15. You can get it on Amazon. Build a Knight's Castle, paper toy archaeology from Annalie Seaman. What a great way to spark an interest in archaeology. You and your child start by reading about how people in medieval times lived and built their castles and defended them. Along the way, Annalie Seaman, who's an archaeologist and educator, shows you how to pull clues from medieval documents, paintings, maps, burial sites, scraps of metal, and more. Then you use that knowledge to build a 3D castle using pieces that pop out of the book. Knights and weapons are included. It's a wonderfully fascinating thing. It's for ages 5 and up. Costs about $11. You can get it on Amazon. Malia's Beach House Building Kit from Build and Imagine. This is aimed mostly at girls, although plenty of boys will enjoy it too. It's a constructible dollhouse, and it helps bring out those all-important STEAM skills. That's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And that includes building, spatial reasoning, and problem solving. Now, Build and Imagine has a whole bunch of kits, all of which use magnetic panels and the pieces, and they're all 100% compatible with each other. This one includes Malia and Skylar, those are two dolls, 17 dual-sided illustrated panels, and a few dozen accessories. Kids design and build their own indoor or outdoor world, and once that's done, they can incorporate the dolls, the clothes, and other accessories, which include dogs, and props to create any scene they'd like to. It's for ages 4 and up, costs about $60. You can get that at buildandimagine.com. We'll be back next week with another segment for you, but you don't have to wait all that long because you can go on to parentsatplay.com and find all sorts of wonderful reviews of toys and games that you and your kids can do together, or you can go to AskMrDad.com and find our Ask Mr. Dad columns. But don't go quite yet because, you know what, there's a lot more positive parenting coming up straight ahead.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Okay, forest animals, today is a new day. Kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow.
Yes?
Have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. Okay, river.
Dude.
How's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man. Perfect for a little riverside shoeless relaxation.
Ah, good. Owl, you here? Of course. Who's asking? I am. Look, you know the drill. Sleep during the day, scare the kids at night.
Perfect. I love my job.
Oak tree?
Sup?
Still in the same place I left you last year. That's what I like. Consistency.
Well, it's not like I'm going anywhere for the next couple hundred years.
I know. I love it. Turtle. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. You'd think he would have learned by now to leave the night before our meetings. Okay. Squirrel. Has anybody seen Mr. Squirrel?
The forest has been preparing just for you. Visit a forest near you today. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Adam Brainer, who is an expert on head injuries and concussions, and we're going to be talking about exactly that. Adam, thanks for joining us.
How are you doing, Armin?
So there's the movie out there, Concussion, with Will Smith, and that's getting a lot of attention these days. But the issue of concussions has certainly been on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. I mean, anybody who's been playing sports recently or watching sports recently. But also military veterans returning with traumatic brain injuries. So, I mean, we're becoming more and more aware of it. But give us an overview of what concussions are and what traumatic brain injury is, and then we'll get into some of the specifics.
Right. So a concussion is just a form of traumatic brain injury. What you have is sometimes identified as a mild traumatic brain injury. But, you know, any injury to the brain is an injury. Is a traumatic brain injury. So it can kind of go the gamut from someone who really has an open head wound, but where they've fractured a skull, but it could be as simple as getting hit in a football game. Or for some of our veterans out there, being in near a blast, and they may not have actually injured anything visible that you could see, but the concussive wave has moved through and sloshed the brain inside the head.
And so that's what it is the brain smacking around on the inside of the skull?
The brain has gotten shifted at a rapid velocity. Either it's been, hit and a force has hit it, or it's been jostled around quite rapidly. And this causes small tears within the axons of the nerves of the brain. And when that occurs, you get an inflammatory response because the tissue's been torn and you get inflammation.
Okay.
Okay, and now when that occurs, it's not going to show up necessarily on some type of imaging like a CAT scan or MRI, unless there's such a tear or blood vessels have been ruptured, you're going to see bleeding. Here you're getting is actually a microscopic type of tear, and what's occurring is some people say, I saw the stars. Or I got a ding, or I'm okay. They just feel a little bit out of it for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they brush it off. But that is something not necessarily to brush off.
Right.
Now, later on, some people, if it's a little more severe, may feel headachy, nauseous, get some blurred vision, they get some light sensitivity, a balance problem. And this can occur shortly after the injury, or can follow, many hours later. Now, everyone used to think, if you went unconscious, that was the problem. But if they never lost consciousness, it's okay. But that's not what the research seems to be showing. It seems to be that even someone who has remained conscious, have no loss of consciousness,
right,
can still suffer from a concussive injury. And, you know, this later on can lead to, you know, issues of memory and emotional issues, concentration difficulties. People can find it difficult to, you know, perform their work or do their schoolwork, or they may have emotional problems occurring where they never had them
sure.
before, like depression or anxiety. And these all can happen after a concussion. And again, you kind of grade, you know, depending on the type of concussion, there are grades
right.
for this. But it is something that, especially when you have more than one concussion over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I want to ask you about, I think, is a little bit about the cumulative effect. And I'm wondering, maybe this will sound like an ignorant medical question, but, you know, you stub your toe or you bang into something, and we all have bumps and bruises, and they go away. Why is it different with the brain, where you can have you have this cumulative effect that it gets worse and worse with time, as opposed to stubbing your toe, which at least it seems like it's not doing permanent damage?
Right. Well, it seems that the neurons become, they have become injured and never fully healed. And the inflammatory response may not have been fully resolved when they have that second or third or fourth or fifth concussion, whatever it might be. And so the brain has this whole inflammatory response and healing response that must occur. And it may not have been completed by the time they had their second injury. And it's different for every person as far as how well they can heal. Younger people are not going to heal, believe it or not, their brains are a little more fragile, and they also don't have the physical ability to withstand those forces, right, from their bodies. You think of a
sure.
little kid, they have a bigger head. A little kid gets tackled in a football game, you know, the size of their head compared to the rest of their body, you know, they don't have the neck strength or whatever even to keep that, mm-hmm. you know, their heads as steady.
Well, you're talking about the word heal. Is there such a thing as healing, or is there recovery and you're always going to have something, even from a relatively, or what may look like a relatively minor assault?
Right. Well, I think that's a good question, and I don't know if we completely know the answer. For instance, I've used EEG to look at the brain for many, many years now. And you can see people who have had past closed head injuries, you know, concussive injuries, on their EEG. In other words, that pattern is still there. It would show up. There's a specific morphologic pattern within the brain waves. And does that mean that it's completely healed? I'm not 100% certain. Now, we do know people can recover their symptoms. And yes, I believe a lot of people can even heal the injuries of the brain. Sometimes it'll heal on its own. But don't forget, our bodies are also assaulted with a lot of other toxins and such that continue to add to the inflammatory response.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you have to think about the sort of the connections within the brain. Okay, for instance, you know, if we are form a memory or some motor skill, our brain sets up many, many pathways that has that mapped out, and that can be a little jostled around with an injury. Now we have a lot of redundancies, and then we can form new neural pathways to compensate for what might have been damaged. And I think that is partially what occurs, that people relearn, you know, how to bring themselves back to the norm. So, you know, there are therapies that we do for folks, like things like neurofeedback or, you know, ocular vestibular therapies. There are things that people can learn to sort of retrain the brain right back to remember perhaps certain things that would have been always there. So I hope that answers a little roundabout in a way of answering it. But can we for sure know that microscopic level within the brain is completely healed? I'm not 100% certain. But, you know, we look at symptoms. We look at other ways of seeing how the brain works and seeing if that does resolve.
Okay. And give us a little bit of a sense of how you would go about identifying a concussion, if you're a layperson.
Well, I mean, if you're a layperson and you got let's say it's your child or anybody else, really, it can happen to anyone at any age. You don't have to be playing sport. You want to see, number one, did they lose any consciousness? Okay?
And right.
That's a very important thing. If they did, it may be a little bit more serious. And if there's any ever a doubt, you bring them to a physician. I think that's the number one to think about, no matter what, whether it's mild or if it's something that you know, oh, wow, that was a really bad hit, because it's not something to be played around with.
Well, but I mean, there are things that as an adult, I mean, probably everybody who's listening to this has had some sort of a thing. You stand up and you smack your head into something, and mm-hmm. it hurts like hell for just a minute or so, and then you just move on. I mean,
and you kind of move on.
Right. Well, you hear something like that.
Are you feeling more headachy? Are you starting to feel fatigue? Is your vision off? Are you in sense of
right.
light? Have you noticed a change in your mood, yourself or your loved one's mood or anything like that? Has it become, you know, those could have been signs that you actually, this was a more serious type of head injury. And that's like a concussion. Now, the standard of care, again, if you don't have any major fractures or anything like that where they would see a bleed and such in a hospital, is to really wait and rest, just to be very, very still, not overtax your brain, not do a lot of physical exertion after that because you don't want to be causing more injury or inflammation within the brain. And a lot of times it will resolve. Okay, people might lose balance problems and stuff, so they'll be looking for signs like that. Can their eyes track properly? Is their balance off? And as those things resolve,
right.
you know, they will say, okay, or, you know, they are now recovering from that concussion. If someone's like an athlete, they'll return to play slowly but surely, watching to see how different levels of activity will affect them.
Right.
And
okay.
Once they're fully back, that's how they will say, okay, they're good to go.
Talking with Dr. Adam Briner, who is an expert in head injuries and concussions and traumatic brain injury. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick up and keep talking to Adam about some prevention strategies. I'm Armin Brandt. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Adam Briner, who is he's an expert in head injuries and traumatic brain injury and concussions. And we've been talking about the symptoms, the signs, and the long-term effects and short-term effects. I want to have you talk a little bit about kids and sports, and I also we'll touch on just general head banging. But, you know, there's so much about sports and kids these days. What is it that can be done to minimize this? Because I think that most families are not going to just, you know, they're not going to want to pull their kid out of sports completely. Are there things that can be done to minimize the risks, at least, if not eliminate them?
There are. I mean, most of those types of things are being hopefully looked at by the coaching staff and or trainers that are working with the various teams. And for instance, in football, they are now starting to go away from some of these more aggressive tackles, okay? No head-on headbutts. I mean, they pretty much said this shouldn't be occurring anymore. So they are starting to take action. And this is really the preventative thing, the best thing you can do. The more you can prevent, the better off you'll have a chance of not ending up with a concussion. But it can happen in almost any sport. I mean, just people say football, because they think it's, the movie Concussion was out and everything like that. And obviously these guys are slamming into each other high velocity.
Right.
But soccer, they're heading the ball a lot.
Right. That one seems like it wouldn't be a big deal, but it really actually is, apparently.
It really is. I mean, you should really think, maybe my child shouldn't be heading a ball until perhaps they're, into their late teens, 18, 19, 20, even to the 20s. I mean, I know it's a skill to learn, but it's, that is an impact. It's not a very strong impact, but repetitive injuries, repetitive impacts will affect the brain. And everyone's a little bit different. So these are types of things to think about. I mean, it can happen in any sport. I mean, we're not going to wrap our kids in bubble wrap and say you can never play. And, because then that's not practical. But you also want to look at preventatively what can you do about just inflammation in general, okay? Children should be eating a low-sugar diet, okay? Hmm. Things that seem to react with the brain a lot and a high amount are things like gluten and, wheat. Wheats are gluten.
Wow.
And even a lot of people have dairy problems. And these might not be as noticeable.
Yeah.
But it can occur that it's a low-grade inflammation, okay? Now, you can have food sensitivity testing done, so you can actually see what's going on with the child. But increase in sugar, which is a very large part of our diet in America, refined sugars, will play with the pro-inflammatory hormones in our body and will directly affect our brain. I mean, our brain and our gut are integrally related. So if you think about this inflammation going on that may be occurring, and now you get a head injury, now you're got another inflammatory cascade occurring at the level of the brain. So you see, you have to think about that. This is actually, it's actually taking care of my child's diet, making sure they get enough sleep, is going to help with the brain healing.
That's fascinating. I don't think I would have ever come up with any sort of dietary approaches to that.
Even your exposure to toxins, pesticides and metals and all these things are in the environment, and they will decrease the brain's resilience,
mm-hmm.
and make it more likely that they would suffer from the effects of a concussion from a head injury. So
right.
All these things have to be taken into consideration.
I'm wondering, I'm going to get back a little bit to the head injury that seems like it's no big deal. And so a friend of mine had one of these things, probably about a year ago. He smacked his head on something and he had a bit of a headache. And then a couple hours later, he was fine. And then the next day, he passes out and he's taken to the hospital and had to have brain surgery, basically had to cut a hole in his skull. I mean, and you hear about these things every once in a while where somebody has a bang in the head, which doesn't seem like a big deal. And then it turns into something life-threatening. How can you tell if your child or yourself, for that matter, if you're okay, really, as opposed to you feel okay, and then, you're in danger of dying 24 hours later?
Right. Now, I think with your friend's situation, they have a bleed in their brain. So the force was enough to shear some blood vessels, and they actually had to bleed inside the brain. And, obviously it's very serious. Can you know for sure? You're not going to always know for sure. It's a really good thing to have, if you're alone, to have somebody that can kind of monitor you. And if you're with your child, you just keep your eyes open and see how they're doing. Are their pupils equal in their dilation for some light? Okay. Are they all of a sudden becoming nauseous and starting to vomit? Right? These are all signs that you have to keep on. Keep an eye on them. And it always pays to call your physician unless you're really feeling like you're okay. But still, you always keep it in the back of your mind to call your physician and say, hey, listen, I banged my head. And they may say, just come on in so they can take a look at you. And they'll monitor you. And they will, at least be able to see how you're progressing. I mean, a case like your friend's, it does occur, but it's obviously not the common thing that can happen. But these things do occur.
No, and I mean the thing that made it so horrifying was that he felt fine,
right,
for a while, which I guess is the operative thing. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so you know, you talk a little bit about just before we went on the air about hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and I'm curious about that as something you haven't mentioned yet, but as another way of helping to heal. What is that about?
Well, hyperbaric oxygen therapy is an amazing therapy that's been used for hundreds of years, and it's increasing the pressure, okay, in a chamber. So you're in a chamber, and you're having 100% oxygen flooding into that chamber, or you're breathing through a mask, and you're increasing the pressure beyond what is a normal, let's say, at sea level atmospheric pressure. When that occurs, some interesting things happen. You know, like I'm at sea level here. You're also where you are. Now, you got a 21% oxygen. But if you go under pressure, you are now 100% oxygen. You're increasing the amount of oxygen over 10 times of what you're breathing. So within 1 hour, you're getting more oxygen than you actually would get into your bloodstream in an entire day. But more importantly is that the tissues and the plasma and the cerebral spinal fluid is getting infused with oxygen in ways that it could never get any other way. This decreases inflammation and swelling. It'll help heal throughout the body. You know, it'll increase blood vessel formation areas that might not have, may have less blood supply to it. It'll help your body detoxify. It'll help fight certain types of infections. So it's used a lot in wound care. Now, this is another kind of wound. The brain injury is another kind of wound. Okay? So they use it for someone who got, let's say, a non-healing, wound or radiation or non-healing diabetic ulcer or anything like that. But imagine your brain, like I mentioned before, it's an inflammatory. It's some type of wound. It's a microscopic wound. So as you increase the pressure of the oxygen, you're pushing it. Almost think like a seltzer or a soda, when you unscrew the cap and the bubbles come up, the carbon dioxide. Well, they had to push that under pressure, the carbon mm-hmm. dioxide, into the water to make that dissolve
right.
in the water. We're dissolving the oxygen into the tissues and into the brain. And that has an amazing, it's actually genetic therapy. Over 8,000 genes are turned on, mostly the anti-inflammatory
wow.
pro-healing genes, and a lot of them are turned off. It's just one session. And so there has been research that has shown that people with traumatic brain injuries will improve tremendously.
Just from one session, because if you use
one
soda
session
bottle.
Will help. You have to do a series of sessions.
Yeah.
People like, for instance, Dr. Harsh, a colleague of mine, did a research study with combat veterans and found that they'll do somewhere between 40 to 60 sessions, and they found about an 80% improvement in it.
Wow.
I mean, it's amazing. I've been practicing hyperbaric oxygen therapy for 13 years or so now, and we've seen tremendous results of people with traumatic brain injuries and strokes and cerebral palsy and mm-hmm. autism and many, many other things because it is such an amazing molecule.
Right.
You dose it correctly,
yeah.
you really can affect great change. And so, we'll use that. I do have, like I said, EEG imaging. We can actually see where when the brain might be injured with, let's say, a concussion, and we can watch and see as it's decreasing that type of injury,
mm-hmm.
and then we also may use something like neurofeedback
right.
to help retrain the brain to help the person out.
Adam Briner is an expert in traumatic brain injury, concussion, and head injuries. Where can people find out more about you?
You can find us on the web at theneuroedge.com, and I am in Connecticut, and I just want to let your listeners know that I'm going to be doing a presentation on concussions and brain injuries within the next 6 weeks or so. And they can always contact my office manager, Rose, at rose@wholebodymed.com. If they want to be notified about this or mm-hmm. if they have any questions they want me to address during the presentation,
sure.
I'll be taking some questions and putting it out there. But hopefully that gives you the information you need
yep.
to contact me.
Great. Adam, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.